Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a former senior U.S. diplomat to Baghdad speaks with us about ISIS. We look into the investigation of last week's massacre in San Bernardino, California. We hear about the blocking of social media in some parts of the world. And William Shakespeare's tragedy, Macbeth, gets a new treatment.
Battle scenes take place on muddy, wet hillsides, which also add to the feeling of desperation and isolation.
It's right here on The Voice of America. The U.S. Defense Secretary has gone to Capitol Hill to talk about the fight against Islamic State. My colleague Victor Beatty is following that story and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, in his first remarks before a U.S. congressional committee since the attacks in Paris and California, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter pledged a greater U.S. effort to inflict what he called a lasting defeat on the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. In testimony Wednesday before the Senate Armed Services Committee, Carter said U.S. Special Forces and the U.S. Train and Equip programs are confronting IS fighters in Syria, while air power and advisors are helping Peshmerga forces in northern Iraq. And he says the U.S. is augmenting Iraqi forces in their bid to retake the provincial Iraqi capital of Ramadi, captured by IS fighters in May.
The United States is prepared to assist the Iraqi army with additional unique capabilities to help them finish the job, including attack helicopters and accompanying advisors, if circumstances dictate and if requested by Prime Minister Abadi. In full coordination, again, with the government of Iraq, we're deploying a specialized expeditionary targeting force to assist the ISF and Kurdish Peshmerga forces and put even more pressure on ISIL through a variety of raids and intelligence gathering missions.
But the defense chief cautioned a greater U.S. ground combat presence in either country could shatter the fragile coalition of fighters united against the Islamic State and enable the IS group to call for jihad. I spoke with Ambassador James Jeffrey, a former senior diplomat to Baghdad, now with the Washington Institute on Near East Affairs. He says he was encouraged by the Carter testimony.
It's a step in the right direction, but we have to get beyond this idea that this war is all about what we will not do. This war has to be what we have to do, which is to take ground back from ISIS. Ramadi is the target right now. The last 98 kilometers of the Turkish border that ISIS controls is next. Eventually, there's Mosul and Raqqa. That's the only way we're going to defeat this scourge. And what ISIS is doing is an extraordinary effect. I just got finished reading that the Kurds are under tremendous pressure. Their economy is being crushed, among other things, by the Russians constantly closing the airspace to fire cruise missiles over Kurdistan territory. Well, Baghdad, of course, is not too unhappy with that because they find Kurdistan to be difficult, so they're not going to block the Russian overflight clearance. And the Russians would do it anyway, but it's, of course, the only justification for it is supposedly to hit ISIS, although they're not attacking ISIS, of course. But this is just another indication of how not just ISIS is totally destabilizing the globe through its terrorist attacks and its occupation of territory, but this unholy alliance of Iran, Syria, and Russia claiming to be fighting ISIS is basically pulling apart the security structures of the Middle East. In some areas, special forces and attack helicopters might be enough. That's Ramadi. In other areas, Raqqa and Mosul, I don't think so.
Mr. Carter, when pressed about a larger U.S. ground presence in the area, suggested that the fragile coalition that is fighting ISIS may, in fact, turn against the U.S. forces.
That's a particular concern about the Shia militias. And the way to do that is, one, make it clear that we're only going in there to seize terrain, not to hold terrain, not to be an occupying force. Two, to make it clear to these people and to the Iranians that the United States sees a real threat from ISIS to our NATO allies. Look at Turkey and France and the hundreds of people that have been killed in ISIS attacks. But now look at us, and that we're going to do what's necessary to take them down.
Ambassador Jeffrey says the call for Turkey and Gulf Arab states to do more to fight the IS threat in the region is not credible. He says they can only make a marginal contribution with small and untested forces. However, he says their political commitment coupled with a token force would be helpful.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today. And joining me with the details is VOA's Sarah Williams. Hi there, Sarah.
Hi, Susan. Well, Paul McCleary, writing in Foreign Policy, says U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter has pushed back against criticism of a stalled war against the Islamic State. Carter said he agreed with Joint Chiefs Chairman General Joseph Dunford, who declared that the Islamic State is, quote, not contained. But he also said the U.S. Is trying to send more military advisors to Iraq. Carter also blamed Congress for delaying $116 million to train and equip moderate Syrian forces. He also criticized Congress for what he called its slow pace of confirming nominees for high-ranking Pentagon jobs. The Associated Press reported Carter told a congressional panel that the U.S. is willing to send more personnel and attack helicopters to the Iraqi army to fight IS. He told Senator John McCain that the Islamic State would love nothing more than a large presence of U.S. forces on the ground in Iraq and Syria so they could have a call to jihad. Well, trending today is hashtag Human Rights Day. It commemorates the day in 1948 when the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. People are tweeting about the death penalty, political prisoners, and freedom of worship. Also trending today is hashtag Golden Globes. Yes, the entertainment award season is upon us, and the Globes are seen as a significant indicator of Academy Award nominations. Among the films nominated for Best Drama by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association are Carol, Spotlight, The Revenant, Mad Max, Fury Road, and Room. Films nominated for Best Comedy or Musical include The Martian, The Big Short, Trainwreck, Joy, and Spy. The 73rd Golden Globes will be handed out on January 10th. Susan?
Thank you very much, Sarah.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
In remarks ahead of a meeting at the White House with visiting Israeli President Reuven Rivlin Wednesday, President Obama condemned the recent violence between Israelis and Palestinians that has left dozens dead since early October.
I've been very clear in condemning the violence that is recurring inside of Israel, the need for leaders like President Abbas to unequivocally condemn the violence that's been taking place, the need to end incitement, but also the need for Israelis and Palestinians to find mechanisms in which to dialogue and arrive at peace. Although, obviously, this is a time at which the prospects of serious peace may seem distant, it's important that we continue to try.
Mr. Rivlin, writing Tuesday in the Washington Post, called on his country to improve communication and cooperation with Palestinians, while Palestinians, he says, must end incitement and violence and end their rejection of Israel's existence. The Israeli president says both peoples appear unable to bequeath to the next generation peace, but urge them to try to build trust. Joseph Ulmert, a political science professor at the University of South Carolina, told VOA, while the current unrest does not provide a climate for negotiations, Mr. Rivlin represents a moderate voice within Israeli politics when he calls on both sides to do more. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study conducted by an international collaboration of scientists predicts the percentage of global carbon dioxide emissions may actually dip slightly in 2015 compared to 2014 levels. According to the report, China emitted 27% of the world's carbon dioxide in 2014. The U.S. had a 15.5% CO2 emission rate, followed by the European Union with 9.5%, and India with about 7%. The researchers say that decreased coal use in China was largely responsible for the decline in global CO2 emissions, and that continued slow growth of annual CO2 output will depend on the use of coal in China and in other countries. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The investigation continues of last week's massacre in San Bernardino, California. Syed Rizwan Farooq and his wife Tashfeen Malik are accused of killing 14 people and wounding 21 in a raid on an office party. He was born in the United States, but she is from Pakistan. My colleague Ken Bredemeyer joins us here in the studio. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Authorities now seem to be focusing a lot on, first of all, how Tashfeen Malik was radicalized in Pakistan, and her husband as well, but also a friend of Farooq's, a next-door neighbor, lived near him for as perhaps several years, and is believed to have sold or given the weapons, a couple of the automatic weapons that Farooq and his wife used to kill the 14 people. What's their relationship? For one thing, this man, Enrique Marquez, is telling investigators that he and Farooq planned a 2012 terrorist action of some sort, but got cold feet, backed out, for the simple reason that authorities at the time were arresting other people in other plots, and they got worried that they were could be in the crosshairs of the Federal Bureau of Investigation as well. So that plot didn't happen, but certainly U.S. investigators want to know more about it.
Now they believe this couple was radicalized long before the shooting.
Not only before the shooting, before they got married. One of the original theories of the case was that perhaps the woman in this case, Tashfeen Malik, had radicalized her husband. That seems not to be the case as investigators delve further into it, that they both were radicalized, that they both had a sense of wanting to commit some kind of a terrorist action. As they met online, as they got to know each other, they dated, if you will, courted each other, and got married, came to the U.S.
Is there any sign the pair were actually part of an organized terror organization?
Federal authorities don't seem to think so. That question has been raised repeatedly, and investigators have not uncovered something in that vein at this point. They believe that the two were self-radicalized and came to be a joint husband and wife assault team carrying out this massacre in California last week.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ken.
Good to be here.
Coming up on International Edition, official blocking of social media and a new approach to a Shakespeare tragedy. The European Court of Human Rights recently ruled that Turkey violated the European Convention on Human Rights by blocking the video sharing website YouTube for more than 2 years. The tribunal ruled that blocking the site infringed on the right of teachers to receive and impart information. Cynthia Wong, a social media expert with Human Rights Watch, now joins us on the line. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thanks for having me.
How common is it for governments to block YouTube or Twitter, Facebook, other sites like that?
Well, I would say that nationwide internet blocking websites has become increasingly common practice in many countries around the world. One of the studies from 2012 found that at least 40, if not many more, including many in parts of Asia and the Middle East, have been engaging in internet blocking for quite some time. I think China was one of the first to introduce this kind of blocking, but the model has been emulated elsewhere in Iran, Vietnam, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, Thailand, many places around the world. And even many places in Europe have started adopting laws that enable blocking material, for example, that promotes terrorism or blocking child abuse images to protect children.
So there is some blocking that's doing good. But what are the problems with blocking?
Sure. I mean, in many cases, you know, a lot of the countries I've mentioned, China, Vietnam, Iran, the government is blocking sites for political reasons, right? They're blocking sites that might be criticizing the government or otherwise they just don't like the content. But even in countries where the aims might be legitimate, so protecting children, this kind of internet blocking raises a lot of troubling issues. In a lot of cases, blocking is completely untransparent and may not even require a court order or any kind of oversight. And so in that kind of environment, it's hard to know, as a citizen, what is your own government even blocking from your view, and could those powers actually be abused? And in a lot of cases, as you mentioned, especially in the Turkey case, internet blocking is also overbroad. So governments might restrict access to an entire website, even if only a single video or blog post could be considered illegal under the law. So it's just really unacceptable under international law to really block all of YouTube simply because one video might be illegal.
Is there anything the international community can do to open up social media around the world?
And I think making it clear that these kinds of overbroad blocks are unacceptable from a human rights standpoint, and as a citizen saying, look, you know, even if one video might be illegal, blocking the entire site actually restricts access to a lot of completely legitimate, perhaps even socially beneficial content. And it's just really unacceptable for governments to be doing this. It's also important to note that many of these kinds of blocks are actually pretty easy to get around. Citizens in places like Turkey and China have been using tools like VPNs or proxies to get around them for quite some time. So I think pointing out that, is this blocking actually really necessary? So even when the goal is legitimate, to protect children, for example, is it really effective at achieving that goal if it's so easy to get around?
Well, thank you very much, Cynthia, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
It's the spacecraft which will hopefully help clear up the cosmic cloud of mystery that surrounds space, time, and gravity. The European Union Agency's LISA Pathfinder spacecraft was launched on the 2nd of December. Its mission, to prove once and for all Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity, or E equals mc squared. His theory, shared with the world 100 years ago, says that to account for gravity, time and space must curve around massive objects like stars, planets, and black holes. This curvature should show up as ripples in the fabric of space-time. These ripples, or gravitational waves, are very faint, and the LISA Pathfinder will test technologies that could one day detect these waves. If this first mission succeeds, there'll be a much bigger mission involving three spacecraft to finally detect the one constant of the universe, gravity. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
William Shakespeare's tragedy Macbeth gets a new treatment from Australian director Justin Kurzel. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the film stars Oscar nominee Michael Fassbender as the doomed Scottish king, and Oscar winner Marion Cotillard as his ambitious wife.
Director Justin Kurzel's Macbeth opens with the title character and his wife standing next to the grave of their only child. Their grief then transitions into a blood-soaked battle scene, after which a victorious Macbeth meets three witches who tell him that he shall be king of Scotland.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Clumps.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor.
All hail Macbeth, that shall be king hereafter.
There's only one problem. Scotland has a king, Duncan, whom Lady Macbeth, played by Marion Cotillard, persuades her reluctant husband to murder when Duncan visits their castle.
I have given suck, and know how tender it is to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out had I so sworn, as you have done to this.
Michael Fassbender, known for his roles in Shame, Inglourious Basterds, and the X-Men series, says taking on the role of the doomed Scot was something that required a lot from him.
There's just so many endless versions you can do, and and various sort of interpretations of it. It's just, which is very encouraging and also kind of depressing, because I would walk away thinking, God, you know, there was another thousand ways that could have been done. But just really becoming comfortable with it.
Cotillard, who won an Oscar for her portrayal of Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose, says she was reluctant to take the part until she talked to director Justin Kurzel.
The way he talked about the fact that he wanted to show that they were in love with each other, and they wanted, and he wanted to show, yeah, the humanity of those two people, really got me, and gave me the desire to be part of it.
Fassbender says Cotillard brought a new vision to the role and was a joy to work with.
She's a really very sort of unique actor, and the fact that she sort of really works very much in the moment-to-moment sort of elements of a scene. She doesn't come forcing something on a scene. She allows it to sort of organically sort of take place, and that's pretty rare.
The film was shot on location on Scotland's Isle of Skye, and the weather and the landscape play a large role in the story. Kurzel's vision also has the characters working in spare surroundings, not grand castles, but empty, dark, cold landscapes. Battle scenes take place on muddy, wet hillsides, which also add to the feeling of desperation and isolation. Macbeth also stars David Thewlis as Duncan, Paddy Considine as Banquo, and Elizabeth Debicki as the ill-fated Lady Macduff. Macbeth is rated R for strong violence and brief sexuality. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On December 10, 1948, still stunned by the horrendous crimes committed against civilian populations during the Second World War, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. At the time, one of the Declaration's chief architects, former First Lady and member of the United States delegation to the United Nations, Eleanor Roosevelt, wrote, "We have found that the conditions of our contemporary world require the enumeration of certain protections which the individual must have if he is to acquire a sense of security and dignity in his own person." Since 1950, the United Nations has celebrated December 10th as Human Rights Day. This day is best known for the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony in Oslo, Norway. However, cultural events and exhibitions focused on various human rights themes take place around the world. This year's Human Rights Day marks the launch of a year-long campaign to highlight and preview the 50th anniversary of two important human rights documents, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Both documents were adopted by the UN General Assembly on December 16, 1966. Despite the tireless efforts and notable successes of numerous national and international agencies, non-governmental organizations, and activists all over the world, there is still much to be done. On this Human Rights Day, let us resolve to work together as a community of like-minded nations to put an end to these abuses and to hold those responsible for inflicting them to account. Ultimately, our goal is to transform our observation of December 10th as a day not about highlighting human rights abuses across the globe, but rather about commemorating the realization of full and unobstructed human rights for all people everywhere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.